Hi, everybody. Nice to see you tonight. We've got three readers, and we're going to get started with David Simpson. Bring him up.
All right, thank you. And it's been a wonderful month. I just want to thank the Vermont CBO Center for all the wonderful support making this happen, and it's just wonderful to be with my new friends. Okay, I'm reading from my first try at a one-person show, and I don't want to say too much, but I do want to position you a little bit with it. the play starts, it's in July, middle of the night, like 3 in the morning. I don't have a title yet. It's in darkness, and we hear rain for a few seconds, maybe a half a minute. And then we hear organ music. It's still dark. And then a mistake would suggest that it's a live performance, and the person kind of goes over something a couple times to get it right. The lights come up, and we see this person reach to the music rack and start reading a score with his fingers, which is probably a good clue that he is blind. And he's playing a piece called For Deinen Thron trete ich hier mit, sometimes referred to as the Bach's Deathbed Chorale. Bach was blind when he wrote it, it means before thy throne I now appear. And the music gives me the opportunity in the play to kind of work with the themes of getting in, whether it's getting into heaven, to the sort of the sacred world as a blind person, to fame as an organist. And it also opens up the possibility of dealing with some religious issues. So at the middle of, like at 3 in the morning, this person walks in, and it's this new priest, and he's actually conversing with her. Her name is Pastor Chris. I think the only other thing is, I mentioned a roly-poly, which is in kindergarten, a friend told him that you could build this thing out of Tinker Toys that would get you out of the school for the blind. You could fly over the roof and go home. So he believed, since it sounded close to Paoli, which was the town near where he lived. So bear with me just till I find where the beginning is. I'm reading on something called a Braille note, so it has Braille display on the front of it. It wasn't the roly-poly that got me out of the Overbrook School for the Blind. It was a hard-headed, bold decision to go as a blind person to public school years before it was commonplace. This would have been high school. The thought of being at home on Sunday nights, watching TV with my sisters, sleeping every night in my bed. Not to sound too dramatic, but the thought was almost as outrageous as a roly-poly. But it was real. It had a motor made of the nuts and bolts of catechism and of doing the math. Maybe you've noticed this, Pastor Chris. Most magic is made of nuts and bolts. How will you take gym? How will you know what the teacher's writing on the board? How will you get books, hand in homework, do biology labs, pass geometry, take tests? I don't know, I don't know, I don't know, but we'll figure it out. And we did, for the most part. A combination of reading Braille books, recorded books, even classmates reading on tape, dad and mom proofreading essays, folding paper to represent 3D drawings in a geometry book. I had way more homework than I was used to. It took a lot of energy. And that didn't include the drain of awkwardness, being dropped into a sighted world. Looking back, I was so stupid refusing to use a cane for the way it made me feel different, although bumping into walls isn't what I'd call normal. Multiply the typical awkwardness of puberty by the awkwardness I felt being blind, and you have awkwardness squared, very squared. I tried out for male cheerleading, track. I even considered the football team. I did become a hall monitor. That was interesting. I was a hero for a day, when I accidentally threw the javelin over the fence by the parking lot and it landed on the principal's car. Everyone said hi to me in the hall for that day. Always admired, never made out with by some girl, wanting every inch of her flesh embedded into every inch of mine in the backseat of a car. I remember being invited to one party in high school. Lots of beer and cigarettes around me in a crowded living room. But by the end of the evening, people had paired up and slipped away to make out in the barn or smoke a joint. There may have been five of us left, none of us good at small talk. I was drinking a can of beer by then. I guess it's really dishonest to say that I only went to one party. I only went to one party of the cool people. But my buddy Evan Halk, I called him Halky, and he called me Ace. He invited me and my brother and a bunch of his friends or people he wanted as friends to his house, and he'd get all kinds of munchies and sodas. Usually the only people who showed up were Gary Gromis and Don Lawrence, two classical pianists, and a couple of girls he knew from Latin III. A typical night, Gromis would be banging out virtuosic pieces. I remember one summer he was working on all the Rachmaninoff etudes, and the girls would be talking in the corner while Halky read Blake to me, or excerpts from James Joyce's Portrait of an Artist as a Young Man, as we sat on the floor in the middle of the living room. We'd get so into it that someone would have to come tell Evan that they were looking for the church key or more ice or something. Those nights weren't cool enough to count, and yet now they are some of my best high school memories. Let me skip forward a little bit. Okay, so then Dave talks about dances and the awkwardness of the junior prom, which I'm skipping. To the visitor, he says, "You're such a good listener, unflappable, really. Speaking of all a little weird, I can't say I've talked about, let alone thought much about, all of these old memories, and with a priest, no less. Well, I guess if you choose to minister to teenagers in this day and age, you can't be living under a rock. Even though I can't see you, I can feel the warm focus of your attention on me. Is this okay, my talking?" He seems to relax a little with her answer. It didn't get easier all that quickly after high school. I rushed three fraternities and got invitations from all of them and turned them all down. I really didn't date. I studied my ass off all week and coordinated over 30 readers. Weekends, I DJed an oldies show and a classical show on the university radio station, and when I wasn't studying, especially when I could have been partying on Fraternity Row, I was down in Rook Chapel at my divine offices. It was my monastery. So one night, as I'm locking up the organ and putting my music back in my briefcase, this woman surprises me when she says, "I love your music." It can be a bit disconcerting when you're totally focused on something and you don't know someone's there with you. He looks directly at the visitor. "So you see, you're not the first." So this girl says, in this creamy, soft, kind of breathy voice, "I love to sit in the dark and listen to you. It's so peaceful here." I don't know how much peace she was getting if I was swearing anything like when you came in tonight. I say, "You mean you've been here other times when I've been practicing?" "A few, but something about the music tonight made me want to say something to you." I change from my organ shoes back into my street shoes. We walk out together as I pull the chapel door closed hard. I tell her I'm heading back to my room in the language house. She says she's going that way. We talk about our majors. She says she's thinking seriously of switching from biology to psychology. Her mother's a psychologist. As we cut through the student center, we hold hands and I ponder how my life would be different if my mom had been a psychologist. "And you, music?" "Music in Spanish," I tell her. "The Spanish came first just because I got straight A's in high school. I'm sure you know how it is for a lot of young people, Pastor Chris. I didn't really know what I wanted to do. I just knew I should be doing it in college. I thought for a little while about electrical engineering. I love radio. But since I couldn't get the engineering books brailled in time, I took a freshman seminar called Christianity and Eroticism, and a Music 100 survey course where we spent the whole first day chanting with our eyes closed, and our assignment each week was to listen to a lot of great symphonies and concertos I didn't know. By this time, we're almost to the language house. She says, I seem like a very spiritual person. I wonder what you would think if you knew me better. So she walks me to my door, and then something else happens that I didn't expect, something that had never happened before. She kisses me, pulls my face down to hers, and kisses me, gently on the mouth. I stroke her hair against my neck, and she parts her lips like petals of a flower, responding to the sun, and lets me, I probably shouldn't say this, lets me explore all of the softnesses in her mouth with my tongue, and then I let her take me in the same way, our arms around each other by now, our bodies begging without words to be closer, and then we're pressing hard against each other until I feel like I'm sinking, being pulled down, forgive me, into Charybdis, oh, so deep down into a whirlpool, down into a wormhole, leading straight to outer darkness, and I cannot breathe. He pauses. As suddenly as it began, it ended. She must have known I was in over my head. But I wanted to dive. I wanted to sin if this was sinning, and I was pretty sure it was. But what about hell? I insisted on walking her back to her dorm, where we kissed again. And if our first embrace had been the pounding waves of a Rachmaninoff piano concerto, the orchestra throbbing yes, yes, to everything the piano said, then this kiss, this embrace at her door, was a Chopin nocturne. Kindly enough, she said goodnight and went into her room, closing the door behind her as I walked away happy. I love you, Sally, I said to myself. It was late. Back in my room, I listened through earphones over and over to the quietest, simplest, my most favorite part of Karl Orff's Carmina Burana, which we were just learning in university chorus, a soprano solo in Trutina Mentis. How on earth did someone so passionate make such a huge decision in her life with a wildly beating heart and put it all into six steady lines, three ending in O, three in ah. I still remember the Latin. Intrutina mentis dubia, fluctuant contraria, lascivus amor et pudicitia. In the wavering balance of my feelings, set against each other, lascivious love and modesty. I choose what I see. Sed eligo quod video. And submit my neck to the yoke. Colum yugo praevio. Colum means neck, yugum, yoke. I yield. I yield to the sweet yoke. Ad yugum tamen. Suave. Suave. Stanzi. I typed it up, just the Latin, and signed it Dave. I had to tell her I loved her. I needed to know if she would decode it. I went back to tape it to her door. Well, as you might guess, nothing much came of it. I stopped by a few times to ask if she'd like to eat together in the cafeteria or get some coffee. But she had a lot of friends to keep up with, and with her heavy course load, she said, Meals were the only times to be with them. I think she was being kind, protecting my dignity in a way. I think she knew me better than I could know myself at that point in my life. But what stays with me is how at ease she seemed, like she already knew what to do when life falls apart, even blows up, like there was a technique to just looking at the pieces on the floor with the kind of mathematician's curiosity, a puzzle that you could get back together. Hell didn't seem to scare her the way it did me. You ever read Joyce's portrait? She was, to me, that girl near the end of the book, poised motionless on one foot in the shallow water, like a crane, and you don't want to move. You don't want to breathe for fear you'll send her into flight. Is that what good art does? Captures the timeless moment, if not the bird? Thanks.